Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is September 10th, 2015, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is The 1 Hour AMI Ruleout: Harder, Better, Faster. And we have a guest skeptic, and it's Daniel McCullum. Daniel is an assistant residency director at Georgia Regents University in beautiful Augusta, Georgia. He loves craft beer, evidence-based medicine, and Batman. Not necessarily in that order. Welcome to the SGEM, Daniel.
It's an honor to be here, Ken. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I can understand why you love craft beer and also evidence-based medicine, but there's gotta be a story behind that Batman.
Well, if you substitute ignorance in the medical literature for fighting crime, Batman is kind of the perfect physician. He's resourceful, prepared, and always fights the good fight.
Oh,
I also alternate reading journal articles with reading comic books to an attempt to stay sane.
Nice. Well, let's kickstart this podcast off with a case.
So a 53-year-old man presents with left-sided chest pain that started 90 minutes ago. The pain radiates to his left arm and has nausea without vomiting. The pain began while he was doing yard work. He's never had pain like this before. His initial ECG is unremarkable.
All right, so for some background, only about 5% of all consecutive patients presenting with acute chest pain will have a STEMI or an ST elevated myocardial infarction.
And STEMIs are actually the easy ones to diagnose and manage.
Yeah, and that leaves the other 95% of chest pain patients.
These are the hard ones.
Yeah, so we need to figure out who will rule in versus who will rule out for an acute MI.
This is where cardiac biomarkers such as troponin play a major role.
And there have been many biomarkers used over the last 60 years to try to identify these patients with AMI.
The first practical test utilized as a cardiac marker was serum glutamic oxaloacetic transaminase, or SGOT, that is now called aspartate aminotransferase, or AST.
I'm so glad that you had to read those out loud. I got the easy ones.
Thanks a lot, Ken.
Yeah, no problem. It's all part about being the guest skeptic. But since the late 1990s, the cardiac markers of choice have changed to this, CKMB, and then to troponins.
A limitation of current troponin assays is that they can take 3 to 4 hours to rise, limiting their usefulness on initial presentation.
Yeah, and this means the diagnosis of a non-STEMI can take hours of continuing monitoring with serial blood sampling.
Ruling out acute myocardial infarction takes time, uses resources, contributes to overcrowding, and causes patient anxiety.
So here's where this high sensitivity troponin assays come in. And they're all the rage now and used by many emergency departments.
They offer very high sensitivity, but are less specific than prior troponin assays.
And there is some limited evidence from studies that the use of high sensitivity troponins may or may not allow for safe discharge of patients more rapidly from the emergency department than what was possible with the traditional troponin assays. So Daniel, what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer today?
Is it possible to rule in or rule out acute myocardial infarction in the emergency department with high sensitivity troponins and ECG in just 1 hour?
So what's the reference we have to answer this question?
There's a paper by Reichlin et al., Prospective Validation of a 1 Hour Algorithm to Rule Out and Rule In Acute Myocardial Infarction Using a High Sensitivity Cardiac Troponin T Assay. This was published in the CMAJ 2015.
So let's run through the PICO. What was the population they were looking at, Daniel?
Patients presenting to the emergency department within 12 hours of onset of non-traumatic chest pain are symptoms suggestive of acute myocardial infarction. This was part of an ongoing study in Switzerland, Spain, and Italy.
And they specifically excluded kidney failure patients requiring dialysis or the STEMI patient. So what was their intervention?
High sensitivity troponin T at both time 0 and time 1 hour, along with ECG.
And what did they compare it to?
The clinical judgment of 2 independent cardiologists.
And what was their primary outcome?
Acute myocardial infarction.
So here are the actual author's conclusions. Quote, this rapid strategy incorporating high sensitivity cardiac troponin T baseline values, an absolute change within the first hour substantially accelerated the management of suspected acute MI by allowing safe rule-out as well as accurate rule-in of acute MI in 3 out of 4 patients. End of quote. All right, so let's start probing the literature with our quality checklist for diagnostic studies, and there's 10 questions here, Daniel. So question 1, the clinical problem, is it well-defined?
Yes, it is. We can rule out myocardial infarction, but can't rule out acute coronary syndrome, including unstable angina.
That's an important point. Okay, so question 2, the study population represents the target population that would normally be tested for this condition, i.e. there's no spectrum bias.
No, the patients may have been more ill. We will discuss later when talking nerdy.
Oh, I like to talk nerdy. Number 3, the study population included or focused on those in the emergency department?
Yes.
The study patients were recruited consecutively, i.e. they had no selection bias?
Yes.
The diagnostic evaluation was sufficiently comprehensive and applied equally to all patients. In other words, there was no evidence of verification bias.
No. Patients that were deemed to be low risk did not always proceed to 6-hour troponin.
Interesting. Okay. Question 6. All diagnostic criteria were explicit, valid, and reproducible, i.e. there was no incorporation bias.
This one's also a no. The challenge of conducting high-sensitive troponin studies is that the diagnosis of NSTEMI, or non-ST elevating myocardial infarction, is a disease entity based on a test without an independent reference standard. Heavy incorporation bias, as described above, comes into play. Changes in troponin seem to be the main basis for the diagnosis of acute myocardial infarction.
All right, question 7. The reference standard was appropriate, i.e. there was no imperfect gold standard bias.
Again, the answer is no. 2 independent cardiologists use their clinical judgment as the gold standard. There is a large degree of subjectivity with this process. Hence, a third cardiologist had to adjudicate 12% of the time. We discovered this through author correspondence. Seems quite high considering the diagnosis of acute myocardial infarction would be a common one for cardiologists to make. It is not clear if this disagreement tended towards overdiagnosis or underdiagnosis.
All right, so question 8. All undiagnosed patients underwent sufficient long and comprehensive follow-up, i.e. there was no double gold standard.
This one's unclear. The follow-up was for a very reasonable 24 months. Contacted multiple times by phone or written form, as well as review of medical records, seems very reasonable.
Question 9, the likelihood ratios of the tests in question are presented in the paper or can be calculated from the information provided?
Yes, it can.
All right, and question 10, the final question, the precision of the measure of the diagnostic performance is satisfactory.
Seems to be so.
Well, let's go through the key results. They had 1,320 patients who presented to the ED within the first 12 hours of onset of non-traumatic chest pain or other symptoms suggestive of AMI. The median age was 60 years, and about 2/3 were men. Acute MI was the final diagnosis in 17% of the patients. And then they took the patients and they divided them up into 3 different categories.
1, those that ruled out for acute myocardial infarction.
And then the second category was a rule-in of acute MI.
The final group was the observation zone, which were patients that fulfilled neither of the previously mentioned criteria, so they did not rule in or rule out.
And so 76% of the patients in this study either ruled in or ruled out for an MI in a 1-hour time frame.
So the first group, 60% of the patients ruled out for acute myocardial infarction. The second group, 16% of the patients ruled in for an acute myocardial infarction. And the third group, 24% of patients neither ruled in or ruled out for acute myocardial infarction, leaving them in the observation zone.
So 60% of patients could possibly be sent home after ruling out in 1 hour. Now the 1-hour algorithm test characteristics were as follows.
So they had a very impressive area under the curve of 0.96.
The rule out zone had a sensitivity of 99.6% and a negative predictive value of 99.9%, while the rule-in zone had a specificity of 95.7% and a positive predictive value of 78.2%.
There was only 1 acute myocardial infarction that was felt to be missed of the 786 patients that were ruled out with the 1-hour algorithm.
So these results seem impressive, but now it's time to dig a little deeper and start doing some critical appraisal. And this was a paper by Reichlin et al. To investigate whether a one-hour algorithm to rule out or rule in acute MI using this high-sensitivity troponin as a biomarker. But we did have a number of concerns. And in fact, how many, Daniel? Five.
There were five.
Yeah. But you know what? To help me discuss these issues, I've brought in a super special guest skeptic, my EBM mentor himself, Dr. Andrew Worster. Welcome back to the SGEM, Andrew.
Thanks very much, Ken. Good to be here.
You're not only my EBM mentor, but you're also a high sensitivity troponin expert and researcher.
Well, I don't know about expert, but my research in the area is funded by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research.
Well, you know, before we start talking a little nerdy, and you're the guy who taught me how to talk nerdy, why don't you tell the SGEMers where we are right now?
Well, right now, Ken, we're in Niagara Falls, Canada, and this is day one of Fallsview Beam.
Yeah, and this is the first of a great Beam season of conferences that you've got lined up. But for the people who can't be here at Niagara Falls for Fallsview Beam, where else are you going to be offering Beam courses?
Well, in just over a week, on September 20th, we'll be in beautiful Quebec City. February 1st, we'll be in Sun Peaks, British Columbia. So if you like to ski, that's the place to go. 2 weeks after that, we're going to be in the Caribbean. I don't want to say anything about the details because I haven't signed the contract yet, but it's going to be any day now, I promise, and it'll be a great value. And then in April, we're really excited. We're going back to New York City, April 20th and 21st.
Oh, so no matter what your CME holiday location that you want to have, Beam will deliver it. So if you want to go to a beautiful old French city, you want to ski, you want to hang out in the sand, or you want to go to New York City, Beam's got it. But hey, let's get back to the show about high sensitivity troponins. And we had some issues, and the first big issue I want to mention was bias.
Daniel mentioned earlier that the challenge of conducting high sensitivity troponin studies is that the diagnosis of NSTEMI is a disease entity that's based on a test result rather than any reference standard. So this can lead to a number of biases that can distort the results.
Well, why don't we go through those biases? And the first one is incorporation bias.
Sure. So incorporation bias occurs when the results of the test under study, what we refer to as the index test, are actually used to make the final diagnosis. This makes the test appear more powerful by falsely raising the sensitivity and the specificity.
Yeah, and the gold standard appears to be 2 out of 3 cardiologists agreeing on the diagnosis of AMI. This seems to have been driven predominantly by defining AMI as a rise in high sensitivity troponin. While this is a commonly used definition of AMI, it is inappropriate to judge the accuracy of a test to make a diagnosis that requires the result of the test.
The results will be much more robust if there was discussion of other tests, such as echocardiography, showing wall motion abnormalities, abnormal provocative tests, future ECG changes, or abnormalities seen on heart catheterization.
All right, and there was the second bias I wanted to mention, Andrew, was partial verification bias.
Right. So partial verification bias, this happens when only a certain set of patients who underwent the index test is verified by the reference standard. This would increase sensitivity, but it decreases the specificity.
And patients that were not deemed to be low risk did not always proceed to a 6-hour troponin. No additional data is given about which patients received additional testing, such as coronary angiography or provocative testing.
It's implied that those that were low risk did not undergo additional testing.
And then the third bias I wanted to mention was spectrum bias. And Andrew, what's spectrum bias?
Well, the sensitivity depends on the spectrum of disease, while specificity depends on the spectrum of non-disease. So you can falsely raise sensitivity if the clinical practice has lots of very sick people, so sicker than those who you would see in the ED. Specificity can look great if you have no sick patients in the cohort. In other words, the word well.
Yeah, and they included only patients who presented to a cardiac research hospital within 12 hours of pain. And these patients could have been potentially more ill. There is also the problem that 20% of eligible patients who failed to complete index testing.
Yes, and we don't know in which direction the loss of 20% favors the bias, but the failure of 20% of those enrolled to complete the first phase of the study raises concerns about the study protocol adherence.
Correspondence with the author revealed a graph showing the outcomes of those that missed the one-hour troponin. This group had significantly lower mortality for the first year after the study, before closely following the mortality curve of the study population. This reveals that this population was fairly different than the study population and appears to have been less critically ill than study patients. The authors calculated a Kaplan-Meier p-value of 0.85, but it's unclear what time period this was done.
So that covers bias, and if you want to understand more about how bias can impact the diagnostic test accuracy, then I suggest you read Kahn, Carpenter, and Newman in AEM's publication back in 2013, and I'll put a link in the show notes. But that covers bias. The second point I wanted to bring up was the risk of overtesting.
Yeah, another concern with this protocol and others based upon high-sensitivity troponin assays is the lack of specificity. The initial high-sensitivity troponin was only 48.4% specific, with more false positives than true positives. If there were inappropriate use of this test in ultra-low-risk patients, there may be a paradoxical rise in the number of patients being evaluated for chest pain in the emergency department.
This is one of my greatest concerns with high-sensitivity troponin use. Similar to the use of D-dimers to evaluate for pulmonary embolism, this tool will need to be carefully applied to avoid over-testing of patients that are too low-risk to benefit.
And the third thing was the imprecision of the assay itself. The change in the high-sensitivity troponin was within the allowable imprecision of the assay itself, so that the change that we're seeing may only be an analytical variation and not actually a clinical variation.
Ken, this is really the keystone, because if the change is within the assay's coefficient of variation, all other issues are moot.
Okay, well, let's go on with the 5 points, though. The fourth one is missed MIs. There was one false negative patient in the study, and it's not clear to me that this single false negative patient was having an AMI from the paper itself.
I agree, Ken. Her peak high-sensitivity troponin T was only 17, and there was no discussion of other factors, such as coronary catheterization or other diagnostic tests.
All right, and the fifth and final thing I wanted to bring up, and I know this is a sensitive topic for you guys maybe, but that's conflict of interest. And Roche supplied the test, and several of the authors had conflicts. And I always say that this does not invalidate or make the conclusions wrong, but it usually makes me a bit more skeptical of the results.
Yeah, I'd be careful here, Ken. You know, greater than 90% of research is funded by industry, and it's not necessarily bad. Also, non-industry sponsors, such as Canadian Institutes of Health Research, actually encourage industry investigator partnerships.
I agree with Andrew about being very careful. The author was very prompt and generous by sharing data with us, and I'd like to thank him for answering our questions and revealing more data to us.
All right, well, Daniel, you did mention that correspondence with the author, and he was super responsive and answered a number of questions for us to better understand this research. So let's just run through some of those questions you had. I'll read out the questions that we posed, and maybe you could give the answers that he provided. So the first one is there data about what happened to those that were excluded due to not having a one-hour repeat troponin, and what were their outcomes?
Outcomes in terms of mortality during follow-up were equal. See the Kaplan-Meier curve with a p-value of 0.85. The initial difference I would attribute due to chance and the different sample size.
And so the second question was, how complete was the follow-up by phone or writing? Were any patients lost to follow-up?
At 30 days, follow-up was complete in 99.7% of patients.
And the third thing we asked was, how often did the independent cardiologist require adjudication by a third cardiologist? And is there a kappa value to assess the inter-rater reliability?
Adjudication with a third cardiologist was required in 12%. No inter-rater comparisons were available.
And then the last question we had is there any information about how the cardiologist decided who was and was not having an MI, and what percentage of patients had a heart catheterization or other testing?
The adjudication was made by clinical judgment, integrating all medical information available up to 90 days, including patient history, lab values, physical examination, and other testing. Coronary angiography was performed in 23%, stress testing in 22%.
Again, Daniel, I think this was a really cool aspect of social media that you were able to reach out to Dr. Reichland, and he was very gracious to respond and help us understand his research better. But it's time to put this into context and comment on the author's conclusions, which I read earlier, and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions. So I'm going to ask Andrew, as a troponin expert, to do that for us.
Ken, I think the authors are much more optimistic of their protocol's current ability to rule out patients in the emergency department than we are based on the data presented. Also, our role in the ED is not limited to just ruling out AMI, but as importantly, to determining if the patient has acute coronary syndrome, and if not, how soon do they require outpatient follow-up.
Excellent. Okay. Well, how about Daniel, can you give us a bottom line then?
Due to aforementioned biases and other factors mentioned, a one-hour protocol utilizing high-sensitive troponin T cannot be recommended at this time.
External validation of this protocol, along with a more explicit discussion of how the diagnosis of acute myocardial infarction is arrived at, might allow for a rapid rule-out in the future.
Well, Daniel, you started this with a case. Can you resolve the case for us now?
Shared decision-making was done with the patient. After discussion with the patient, he agreed to stay in the emergency department for 6 hours. His troponin at 0 and 6 hours were both negative, and serial ECG showed no ischemic changes, and his pain had completely resolved. He was discharged home with close follow-up with his primary care physician and strict return precautions in case symptoms returned.
So here's how I'm going to apply this clinically. High sensitivity troponins may, or may not, have future clinical applications to rapidly rule out low-risk patients for AMI. But it's unclear at this time what effect the low specificity will have. So Daniel, what are you going to tell your patients?
There's a new blood test that checks for very early damage to your heart. If you're having a heart attack, this test often picks up early signs of heart injury. However, the test is so sensitive that it may suggest that you're having a heart attack even if you aren't having a heart attack. In order to be as sure as we can be, we'll need to get multiple heart tracings and do more than one blood test.
Well, that sound means that it's time for the Keener contest, and last week's winner was Alan Seelaff from the University of Michigan. They were able to name 3 superheroes who obtained their powers from radiation exposure. This week's Keener contest continues that geeky superhero theme. What's the question, Daniel?
Every Batman release includes the credit, Batman, created by Bob Kane. Who's the uncredited second creator of Batman?
Ooh, well, if you know the answer, then send me an email at thesgem@gmail.com with Keener or Batman in the subject line. The first person to correctly answer the question will receive a cool skeptical prize. I just want to remind everybody about some conferences that are coming up. Andrew mentioned earlier we have Quebec Beam September 21st and 22nd in Quebec City.
And if you haven't been to Quebec City, it's absolutely beautiful, and September is a wonderful time to go.
And then I'm going to be heading out to Whistler, BC for St. Paul's Emergency Medicine Update September 24th to 27th. And then I hope to see a lot of people at ACEP this year, October 26th to 29th in Boston. And if you see me wandering around the halls, please come up to me and say hi. And then there's the teaching course in New York City with Rob Rogers, November 10th to 13th. Really looking forward to that one. Anyways, always great to have my EBM mentor back on the show, Andrew.
Oh, it's always good to be here. Thanks, Ken.
And thank you, Daniel, for reaching out to me and suggesting this paper.
It's an honor to assist you in your goal of reducing the KT window down to improve patient care. Thanks for what you guys do.
No problem. And if you have a paper you think that we should put our skeptical eye upon, then click on the Hot or Not button on the website. Each Friday, 5 new articles are posted for SJammers to vote on, and those papers registering as hot will be reviewed. Also, the SJam has gone global. The blog and podcast is now available in 4 languages: English, French, Spanish, and Portuguese. We are trying to cut that KT window down to less than 1 year by eliminating language as a barrier. So check out the sjamglobal.com site, and if you're passionate about emergency medicine, FOMED, speak another language, and have always had this secret desire to podcast, then send me an email to talk to me about joining the SJam Global team. Daniel, it's time to give the SJam tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week. Never.